I just want to give you sort of a framework of where I'm coming from, because there are kind of three entities involved in the project that I'm working on. Maine Health, which is the overarching organization, and that's who I work for, the Maine Health Network, Maine Medical Center, and the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making. Maine Health is the largest health network in the state of Maine, and it is also, I think, in the north of Boston, the largest health network. Maine Medical Center is the parent company of Maine Medical Center. My position is based at Maine Medical Center, even though I work for Maine Health, and we have received a grant from the Foundation for Informed Decision Making to investigate the shared decision making project. So those are the players, and I have no relationships to disclose either, no financial disclosures. Shared decision making defined. I'm not sure how many people here are involved with shared decision making. Is there anybody here who's doing shared decision making in their practice? Not yet. Okay, so I'll give you a little bit of a background on what shared decision making is. It is the shared decision making process results in medical decisions that are shared by doctors and patients, informed by the best evidence available about alternative treatments, and it's weighted according to specific needs, preferences, and the values of the patient. And we use decision aids, which are in various formats. Primarily, they are DVDs, which are developed by the Health Dialogue. These are approved by the Foundation for Informed Decision Making. There are other types of decision aids. There are many types of decision aids actually available, and some online. But they are they're developed so that they offer a booklet and a DVD so that patients can either read or view information about the decision that they're working with. So it'll be a real physician on the DVD. There are no actors. There are three patients who may have different experiences, who are approaching their condition from three different perspectives. So it gives the patient an opportunity to see that there's more than one decision to be made. So again, these are preference-sensitive conditions. Elective surgeries are used a lot with the Center for Joint Replacement. There are certain cancer screening. PSA is a big one right now. It's probably the one that I use most frequently. And colorectal cancer screening, a lot with diabetes. Decisions, again, these are about self-care, menopause, depression, chronic low back pain, etc. Cochrane has stated that the use of decision aids in primary care really provides, obviously, greater knowledge, more accurate risk perceptions, a greater participation in decision making about what the patient wants to do, and people move on a little quicker when they have that extra information, so they're less likely to, they're more comfortable with their decisions. They also believe that it may lead to a better care plan adherence and better outcomes, and of course reduced costs of care, which was mentioned earlier. I mean, we all want to save money, and so this is one, there's an upfront investment in time with the patient and with the practice, but the end result is that people are more comfortable with the decisions that they make, and they're more ready to act on them. So in that sense, it's sort of like other methods that are being used now, the teach back. It seems cumbersome at times when people are asked to take on those new learning skills or to develop a new plan, but in the end it really does save time and reduces readmissions and so on. So here we are with the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making, and they have awarded the Maine Health this three-year grant to integrate the decision aids into six primary care practices, which includes the outpatient medical center. So the reason for this pilot is to identify the best practices to and to assess the impact on the providers and the patients via the data collection and surveys. I will say that of all of the practices, Maine Medical Center, the internal medicine clinic at Maine Medical Center is unique in that it is hospital-based. We do use them in another hospital, but it's not quite as robust as the program that we have at Maine Medical Center. And I'd also like to say one other thing about Maine. Because we're talking about cultural competency, everybody's probably going like, well, Maine, it's like really the least diverse state in the nation. It is absolutely the whitest state and has the least amount of diversity. However, Portland, Maine, which is where Maine Medical Center is based, has a lot of diversity. For a small city, it's a large city in the state of Maine, and we have a very large refugee population in Portland. We have the largest, I think the second largest Somalian community in the country. And so that's continuing to grow because they're, you know, it's very family-based culture, community-based culture. So, you know, more people are coming. And we have Catholic Charities of Maine, which sponsors many of the refugees who come to the States. And they're very active in bringing people in from Somalia. We have people from Iraq. We have people from Afghanistan, Cambodia, Vietnam. I think Portland High School is one of the high schools in the country that speaks the most languages of any high school in the country because there are so many small communities within Portland. So we're really excited about that because we're getting to finally have some diversity in our state. And the clinic is very actively involved because of the opportunity to work with patients. So, as I just said, we have Maine Medical Center is the only demonstration practice among five at Maine Health to consistently, and that's the other thing that we do is we consistently provide face-to-face shared decision making. Many of the other practices that are involved with this pilot project are often giving the decision aid because there's a limit in staffing. So they're giving the decision aid to the patient or mailing the decision aid home to the patient and saying, you know, have a look at this, tell us what you think when you come back in. The advantage of Maine Medical Center's project is that they have me, and I have a center, so we've made that partnership, and that works really well. So we have yet to see if that, you know, skews things a bit. It already has, and we can see that in the data. So you can see by having on-site health educator available to provide face-to-face decision support, there's an increased patient satisfaction, better understanding of the preference, sensitive screening, self-management, and chronic conditions. So here's our patient population. We have 30% refugees and/or people with limited English proficiency. We have a very vulnerable population in the city. At the clinic, 24% are free care, 30% main care, 13% Medicare or dual, 16% dual main care, Medicare, and 14% self-care. 96 studies show, this is a quote from a study, that low health literacy is associated with poor medication management, less preventive care, more depression, and higher all-cause mortality. The barriers are obvious. I'm sure all of you in healthcare know that providers have limited time, and shared decision making does require time. And it, again, as I said earlier, is an investment in time and resources up front. And this is an interesting fact, I think, is that providers, surprisingly, have the misperception. They often feel that low health literacy is a reason to not engage with patients. You know, that idea that, oh, they're not going to get it anyway. So this is something, again, that needs to be changed, and we need to work on that so that more education and what Megan, the work that you're doing is really exciting. And, you know, I think having that training for providers, especially for medical students as they come up through the system, is vitally important. And we do have, Maine Med is a teaching hospital, so we're doing some of that, but we need to do more and we need to institutionalize it. So the Learning Resource Center is where I work. I'm with MaineHealth, and we have two branches. There are many things that MaineHealth does, but I'm in the community health program at MaineHealth, and we have two branches. We have the Center for Shared Decision Making, and then we have the Learning Resource Center, and I kind of do both. So the Learning Resource Centers, there are five Learning Resource Centers throughout the greater Portland area, or southern Maine, and one moving up towards western Maine. And we started in 1999 with one center, and now we have five. And we are a lending library. We're open to the general public. We welcome people to come in off the street. They don't need to have an appointment. Usually they're coming directly from their provider visit, so we don't get too many walk-ins, but it's possible, and we organize classes based on needs within the setting where we are. We do many different things, but it's a great opportunity to do the shared decision making. So we have, as I said, all of these wonderful things available. And each is staffed by a certified health education specialist. So each health educator has core competencies. They may have a different background in some areas, but they have core competencies in health literacy, cultural competency, and shared decision making. And this is exactly, as I said, some of the training that the health educators have. And the opportunity to work with a translator at Maine Medical Center is a great advantage. We have wonderful interpreter services departments, so I can do telephonic appointments with patients. I can have them come in, and I can have an interpreter there. I can have I have great access to many foreign language websites that I can use when I'm doing my shared decision making. This is the workflow that we use. So the provider at the clinic identifies the patient and creates an electronic order, or they will send the patient directly to me. They'll back it up with a written order. And if the patient needs to be contacted to set up an appointment, then I do that. And the patient will come in at a certain time, and we'll have about an hour, sometimes with an interpreter. Usually, if they don't speak English at all, then we will always use an interpreter, medically trained interpreter. And we don't allow family to serve as the interpreter, and there are good reasons for that. So we keep it very professional. We do have a pre-test and a post-test that we do during this pilot, just to see what the patient knows before they view the decision aid, and what they understand after they view the decision aid. And this way we can sort of see what it is that, where we need to fill in the gaps. And we can either go back in and talk a little bit more about what it is that they have not understood, and also provide them with additional information that they can take home, perhaps to share with their family. And then the health educator documents the encounter in the patient's chart, so that they do know what has happened. So this is just sort of, you know, data on, you know, what ones we've viewed. These are the key points from the survey. As you can see, we also ask in the post-survey how much they have gotten out of viewing the decision aid and the whole encounter experience. Very favorable at Maine Medical Center. Favorable in the other areas too, but we have, because of the face-to-face, we're assuming that there's a more favorable result. So patients report a high degree of satisfaction with a one-on-one encounter. They think they're extremely useful. The best evidence, of course, comes from the patients themselves, because they've seen the video. Further study is needed to see if the impact of the DA alone, what the difference is between the two. And so we have to look beyond the patient satisfaction, treatment choices, and that's the other thing, the treatment choices and behavior. We need to close the loop a little bit better, make it a little tighter, because right now, sometimes that patient may not have a follow-up visit with their provider for another 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And I don't always, hear whether or not they really had a conversation about what they came to see me about. So that needs to be tightened up, and we're working on that. ARC has this report that low literacy, again, we're talking about health literacy here, and this is another way to provide health literacy to patients. Health literacy is not just the written word, it's also the spoken word, it's the cultural competency, it's all of it. And so we feel very strongly that this is a great opportunity to bridge that gap. And we also know that this study on the bottom shows that knowledge scores are slightly lower for people with low literacy skills, but only slightly, and they're comparable to people with more adequate literacy skills. And we want to always keep in mind that, I know we talked earlier about with breastfeeding that, you know, you can test for literacy, but really we know from the National Health Literacy Study that most Americans really read at between a 7th and an 8th grade reading level, and most information is delivered at a high school or above, particularly in healthcare. So we really need to be aware of that with all of the materials we develop, all of the verbal communication that we have, that even if someone has a college degree, when they have a medical condition, they're not going to understand. And that doesn't mean you talk down to people, but you do speak in plain language and you write in plain language so that people really understand it. And the teach back is a great way to test that too. And again, when you do teach back, it's really important that the onus is on the provider and the speaker, not on the patient, that they should not feel in any way intimidated. And sometimes testing can intimidate people because of they're already nervous about their medical condition. And again, keeping in mind that the most vulnerable populations have the most limited, often have the most limited literacy skills, and those groups with limited literacy skills obviously have poorer health. And so we know that from the National Assessment of Adult Literacy. So we just always want to keep that in mind for every encounter. And I mentioned plain language in all forms. Remember that it's communication, print, verbal, all of that. And the most common results of studies is that good decision aids help those with less knowledge as much as those who know more. So the conclusion is that there's hope that the health educator model can extend communication capacity of the provider, and those that are in the most need and with decision support have the most to gain, and that our experience shows that there are innovative ways to make shared decision-making possible. And so I encourage everybody to look at that as an opportunity. And again, even if you don't have the exact tools in your office, there are wonderful tools available online that you can look at and use in your practice. And it can close the gap between those who start out with less and more knowledge. And be happy to talk with you or share the website for Maine Health with you on health literacy. Thank you.
We have just under 15 minutes, about 14 minutes for questions, so I'd like to open it up. And also, I believe I'm supposed to be repeating the questions because this is being recorded, and I thought that if it's manageable for those, if a question is directed at one of our panel, if they could come up to the mic to answer would be probably helpful if that works, and if it doesn't work, we'll just maybe be a little more informal, but otherwise try to work with the recording situation that we have here. So what questions does anyone have here? Yes.
I'm Pat Garrett, American Academy of Family Physicians, and we have a website called familydoctor.org, which is tries to maintain a reading level of 5th to 6th grade. And it's extremely difficult to write medical terms that are polysyllabic, to where people, you know, even the editors of our website, when I did an analysis of a Gunning-Frog index, they were coming in at, you know, grade 16, mm-hmm. and, you know, but they demand that we write health education materials at the 5th and 6th grade level, which is really a challenge. Mm-hmm. Do any of the panelists have any ideas how to overcome this?
So the question is about how to overcome the challenge of getting the terminology, getting the reading level down to about fifth to sixth grade, including websites and in other materials. Anyone would like to answer that? So it sounds like the solution is taking some of the longer words out, defining, using phonetic spelling, removing those when you do the literacy.
I would recommend a health literacy specialist. I mean, this is not work that is done easily by anybody who's had even just basic health literacy 101. There's a health literacy institute. We have a whole website on health literacy at Maine Health, and we have guidelines, and we have experts, and we have, there's lots of people that are working on health literacy right now. It's a very exciting field. It can be done.
Or health literacy specialists as well. So the next, would someone like to come up? Did you want to come up, Mr. Pacheco?
I'm sorry, I just want to make sure we get this information into the record.
From a federal standpoint, whenever we develop a particular product that we want to post on the website, we have to follow the plain language kind of guidelines. Additionally, we have to make sure that everything is 508 compliant. So if we're not, then they zap us. they won't let us post it. So,
what do you do?
Well, we have experts that have a contractor, basically, that helps me, you know, make sure that we meet all those requirements. And so they have that expertise. So.
Next question?
Yes. I just have a comment, and I really like your definition of cultural competence and not being very focused on one culture, because, you know, there's and I was wondering how you address, like, subcultures within one. So let's say Maine is not necessarily very diverse, but there's older people, there's poor people, there's LGBT people. So there's always some way that there's a difference, right? And people do have pre-bias. So do you have any other panelists who really address this, but how do you address that, and especially the LGBT?
Who would like to speak on the diversity and what it means, what cultural diversity means, and how to address that?
Good. I think for us that's one of the reasons we really like the LEARN model, because it can be used with all patients no matter what their cultural background. And so basically it's just asking those questions, because we need to understand, and what you mentioned is there's really as much diversity as well within cultures as there is across, so we can't assume anything about a patient just because they're, you know, ascribed to a certain cultural group. So by using the LEARN model, we can elicit those health beliefs and behaviors from individual patients and get a better understanding from their individual culture and how we can work with that individual to make those health decisions. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I agree with you, and I think that's why the LEARN model for us has been so important to teach as a method.
Okay.
The programs that we have on our website, we also use the promote the learn model. Okay, but getting back to your diversity question, for example, Latinos, Hispanics, all of you in this room could be Latino or Hispanic. Right? Yeah. For example, a new concrete example: the previous president of Peru was what? Fujimori. All right. So I think we just got to understand that, you know, we're all different, right? But we all have our respective kind of cultures that we come from. The LGB community, even within Latinos, there's a subculture, all right? The deaf community, the hearing impaired, that's a subculture. So we just got to be more open-minded and more receptive that, and to kind of appreciate differences, and that we don't all look alike, we don't all speak the same language. You know, we were all created by, you know, the Almighty, whoever, differently, to speak languages and, you know, practice different cultural beliefs, etc. So we just got to be more open-minded in terms of how we deal with people.
Yes.
I'd like to, in the training that I do, and I wanted to ask also, because I saw that you're looking at some sort of self-awareness with the physician, and I think that's really important, because part of it, what I teach is that culture is not ethnicity, and we've made it synonymous, and it has nothing to do with it. It's learned behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes, and it's learned. So one thing I try, especially with providers, is to explain to them, you have a culture of providers, and you see that in your work every day. Physicians act a certain way, nurses act a certain way. Are they all exactly the same? No. But you do have a culture, and so I really try to do that in the beginning to show them that you have one, and you learned it, and so we have to learn something different later so that you see that you are also a part of that cultural interaction with your patient. You affect it just as much as they affect it. And so that's kind of what I try to do, is to get them out of that box of having it be ethnicity. And I really like the definition of culture that's just, it's learned behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes. Because you learn it, it's a behavior, it's a belief, and you act all of that out. And so I wanted to know, because that's what ends up happening, is I feel like providers will say, oh, well, yes, now I know their culture and I understand all of that. But if you don't understand your own, you have no idea how you're affecting that interaction. And, you know, and things as simple as, how am I supposed to teach someone else when I've only learned it in all of my training as one way? I mean, that's how I've learned every disease, everything about my medical knowledge, I learned in a certain way. And so that's the only way I know how to teach it. So just to be good.
You could come up here and sit at the. Go ahead.
I agree with you. I think that's so important. I actually would like for us to do more of that, because when I mentioned awareness of self, we do a few activities that look at how communication is tied to culture, and because we really focus on communication as a key to providing quality care across difference. And so we look at communication styles and how that can be related to culture. So we do an exercise that recognizes those different factors. And then we also look at cultural worldviews and where they may be on a continuum, for instance, social status, whether it's earned versus ascribed or you know, kind of on a continuum, they kind of rate where they are and then how comfortable they feel working with patients who may be different. So we kind of go through a couple exercises, again, around worldviews and communication. But I would like to incorporate more on the culture of healthcare and medicine, and particularly Western biomedicine, and how that is a culture. So if you have ideas, you know, I'd love to talk later about how to incorporate that, because I think that you know, there's a certain style of dress, a certain language, you know, it's a culture. And so I don't think people realize that, because when you're living that culture, you don't realize it's there until someone points it out to you.
Well, they've been taught that year after year after year in school. I mean, the whole time that they're in school, that's what they're being taught.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Yes?
I have a question for Dr. Whitman. This was on the tool realm team.
Right.
Did I hear you say that it's just assessing pronunciation of the words, but does it get at all at comprehension and usage of the different words? And if not, how is that measuring literacy?
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's a
topic of major discussion in the health literacy community. It is basically kind of a word comprehension test. When they've looked at this test in comparison to, say, the TOEFL, which does include numeracy skills and maybe some functional knowledge, it is highly correlated. But all of these tests are just a proxy, and I think you had mentioned that really you can't actually measure someone's ability to health literacy, like their ability to really navigate health systems and have all those skills required. So each test that we have, whether it's the RELM, the TOEFL, the S-TOEFL, they're all proxy measures. But that's a really good question, and that's kind of why we wanted to look at the TOEFL in our population, because it does at least include numeracy skills and isn't just kind of a test of word comprehension.
And I had a quick question, too, for on your work, if you wouldn't mind, about how you use the qualitative data that you all gathered. What is your plans for using it, or how did you put that?
That's a great question. Initially, when we had organized our study, we wanted to use that data to feed into our survey. And what we're doing right now is just piloting the qualitative part of the study, because we really need a fairly decent number of participants to be able to find the effect of health literacy on breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. But we'd like to put in other factors that are important that I discussed, so like social support, exposure, and that's why we did that qualitative survey to find out what's important in our population and what affects breastfeeding.
Okay.
So a further study would actually be able to incorporate that and as well as health literacy, if we find in this pilot study that they're associated. So that's kind of how we'd like to bring it all together and triangulate those results.
Okay, great. Well, I think this is a great panel, and I think our time's about up, so I'm sure people will stay around, and I'd like to give them a round of applause.